This is the Dave Durant Show with Dave Durant.
Welcome to the Dave Durant Show, where faith and the workplace meet. We discuss the tips, tools, and resources to help you become a better leader, because Lord knows we need better leaders in the home, in the workplace, and businesses. And as always, I'm joined by our host, Dave Durant. Dave, now you were asked to send a video over to St. Vider Catholic High School's Entrepreneurship and Investment Club. Say that five times fast. And so we're going to play that segment here in just a moment. But did you want to speak on that, what they asked you to do, and a little bit about the video?
Yeah, I loved it. You know, they asked me if I could just send a short message encouraging them to take a look at entrepreneurship and investing from a faith perspective. And so I was able to do that. And we're going to share the segment because we thought, you know what, there's probably a lot of people here of all ages who would be able to benefit from this. But there are many people who just want to share this with their youngsters and to encourage them to, you know, take a look at it from that perspective. Hello, St. Vider Entrepreneur and Investment Club. This is Dave Durand, and I am happy to be with all of you because you are budding giants. And I love the idea of the class because it's entrepreneurship and investing, and these things go so well together, but they also go together with something that's even more important, and that's your faith. And I will tell you, there's a couple of things that I want to talk about on ideas for investing, ideas for being an entrepreneur, but the way that your faith plays a role in that. I call this actually the Catholic advantage. And, you know, there's some of our Protestant brothers and sisters believe in something called the health and wealth gospel, which is in essence to say that the more you pray and the more you tithe, the more God's going to bless you. And in essence, almost like if you're not tithing and praying, that you can't have abundance in the world, and almost like God's transactional. And of course, we know it doesn't work that way. But we also know that there are two things that exist out there, the laws of nature and natural law. These are two different things, but they also work kind of harmoniously in a particular way together. And that is to say that the laws of nature, which would be that we eat nutrition and our bodies are healthier, okay? And the laws of the natural law, which is to say that we have a conscience that is built into us and we follow that conscience with good behaviors, we actually have a more blessed life. Ultimately, these things get us to heaven. But the most important thing to consider here is the Catholic advantage in this. If you are a person who lives by the cardinal virtues of prudence, of justice, of fortitude, temperance, and you allow your heart to grow into those theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity, and if you see the world from a transcendental desire perspective, which is goodness, truth, beauty, and unity, a lot of these things you're probably learning in your classes. And if not, you should tap in and ask yourself, why is he mentioning these things? Because frankly speaking, if you do live your life as a Catholic, you will have the highest level of success that you possibly could on earth because those natural principles are there. Now, God does not call every one of us to have a life of abundance, and this is a key thing. He's calling some of us to much more modest and simple lives. I was actually just talking to my son. He's going to be ordained a priest in May, and two other seminarians. We were enjoying a nice cigar, actually, outside. Hopefully your teacher doesn't feel that that's offensive and needs to remove it. But we were having a great cigar outside, and we were talking about the idea of what it means to be holy, and their calling. You know, they were called to be priests. And what it means to be called everywhere. Well, you know, what is the vocational calling that you have? And before I get into some of the specifics on entrepreneurship and investing, I just want to mention this. You know, I said, listen, I think one of the problems that the church has is that sometimes her members communicate to people that you have to choose between two good things often. Now, we have to choose between good and bad things, sin or righteousness, clearly, okay? But we don't have to choose between many things in the world that some would have us believe we need to choose, unless we're not called to have them in our lives. What does that mean? Well, I'm not called to be a priest. If I said I want to be a priest and I tried to become a priest and I went through the process and I was accepted to become a priest in the seminary, I wouldn't be ultimately a great priest because it's not my calling. Likewise, if somebody's called to a simple life to become a priest, wanted to try to become a billionaire, they're not called to that, and that's a problem. Ambition gets in the way, and attachment gets in the way. But the idea that you would invest and invest wisely if you are called to that type of life, or to lead, or even be well-known and powerful, is good if you are called to it. And again, not everybody is called to it. But if you're called to it, you can do a lot of good, right? Why? Because the person who's running the non-for-profit and has that simple life will will be in a meeting talking about how to fund their non-for-profit, and they'll want to talk to you because you have the wealth to be able to fund it. That's the body of Christ. So ask yourself, what are the skills that I have? Don't be ambitious, be driven. An ambitious person is a person who seeks recognition or power, or influence, or even wealth beyond what they're capable of handling or beyond what they merit and what their skills have. But a driven person is willing to go through the process of becoming that person. And if you pay attention to this vocationally, good things are going to happen. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the whole idea of entrepreneurship. I love it. It's not for everybody, but I love it. If it is for you, it's quite a blessing. So this is one of the reasons that you want to ask yourself, am I called to be an entrepreneur? Am I called to lead? Am I called to be a person of influence in this capacity? Now, each one of us, to a certain degree, will have some of these things just kind of innate in us. But to what degree, you have to consider. And here's one of the ways you learn how to do it. When you're young, explore it. That's the great thing about it. You know, one of the ways, we don't just learn what our calling is by sitting around praying in the dark and then, you know, having God send us some, you know, FedEx overnight letter and then opening and going, okay, your prayer is answered. One of the ways you find out is you go do a bunch of things. And if you do a bunch of things, you start to figure them out. And one of those things that you can do is to take action as an entrepreneur. Now, I love entrepreneurship for young people because there's so many things you can do that you can't do other places, like use the fact that you are young as a little bit of a marketing tool in a righteous and good way. So, you know what? Going back, if you're 14, 15, 16, 17, even 18 in college, you could go out there and I'll just give you a for instance, and then you have to generalize this. Now, I have told this, young people, they say in college a lot of times, they say, what job should I have in preparation? I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be in sales. I want to be an entrepreneur. I say, you know what? Find a job that you don't like, that is long hours and is physically demanding that you want to quit halfway through. And I'm going to tell you why. Because the most important determination or determiner for your success later on in life is the virtues that you build. And they're not only prudence, which is making great decisions, but they're fortitude to fight through things you don't feel like doing. And so what I have found is the most common thread of success for people is that they can endure difficult times in order to get to the better times. And they're willing to be patient in all things, but eager to take action immediately. And so if you find a job that you don't really like, that includes long hours and is physically demanding, you're going to become something more. So your job when you're young is more about who you become while you're doing it than what it is you're doing. In fact, throughout life, it's often that, but you start to find things that maybe you have a greater desire for, you have a greater like for. And God does that. He orients us toward things that we do enjoy in order to pursue them more. But when you're young, it's not so much that way. But here's one of the reasons that I start with that, because I would pick manual labor jobs that you can actually, that you can make money on as an entrepreneur. I'd buy a lawnmower and I'd go ask the neighbor if you can mow their lawn for whatever amount. You can get a surprising amount for that nowadays, okay? And you pick a price that makes sense. How do you do that? Well, think like an entrepreneur. How much is the gas going to cost? How much does a lawnmower cost? What do I need to do time-wise, okay? If I'm going to spend an hour mowing this lawn, okay, and that's going to cost me, you know, $6 in gas, I'm going to have a $44 profit. Plus, I have this lawnmower, and if you didn't buy it yourself, or you have a payment on the lawnmower, what is that payment? And you think about those things. So let's say, you know, on each project, you have $10 you need to put into it, but you get $50 for the project. You're making $40 an hour. Do you know many places that you can make $40 an hour as a 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old person? Probably not. That's a good way to do it. And then what you do is you find 10 other neighbors who are going to allow you to do this. You're probably going to mow their lawn once a week. If you find 10 of them, you have about a $400 profit weekly, and you're only working about a day and a half in the sun, enjoying it. That's pretty cool. Okay. And you've built a business. Now, what if you find 20 and you try to keep up with 20? Well, it's going to be a little more difficult sometimes if there's some rain in between. You got to try to cram these in. So, you know what you do? You hire the neighbor kid and you say, I've got a great job for you. How much is minimum wage? And they're like, I don't know, whatever it is. You say, well, I'm going to pay you double minimum wage. And you're paying, what is minimum wage for Nico? Do you even know? I'm talking to my producer right here. I don't remember what it is. Well, he's looking up what minimum wage is so we can have that for you. But the idea is that you could be attractive to somebody else your age that's responsible, and you could pay double minimum wage at $12. Okay, so you could pay them $24, or I'm going to just keep it simple at 20 just for the math. You could pay them $20. Now, if you were making a $40 profit before, now you're making a $20 profit, but you're not doing the work. You had to buy an extra lawnmower, though. That's what you needed to do. So so you're making a lot of money now, or you start charging $60 because you've got demand. People like your service. You're good at your service, and you pay that person $20. You're walking away with a $30 increase. Now what you can do is you can start spending a little bit more of your time finding more customers and clients. What happens if you build this up where you've got four kids mowing lawns full time? They each have 25 lawns they're responsible for. And by the way, I don't know the capacity for one kid mowing lawns. It may be more than that, but it depends on the type of mower that you have too, and the trimming and quality that's involved. You're getting the essence of this. You need to build this in reality. But if you had, for simplicity's sake, 100 lawns that you're taking care of, and you are making $30 a profit on each lawn, that's $3,000 that you're making in a week. That's $12,000 in a month. And you've stopped mowing the lawns because you're managing the books on this. That's $144,000 income if you're in a warm weather place like Florida. In the wintertime, you might have to convert that to shoveling driveways. I don't know. But the idea is, look for an idea like that that can grow into something. Why? It's not about mowing the lawns. It's about learning to sell. It's learning to organize. It's learning to recruit. It's learning to do high quality work with some responsibility. It's learning how to scale something to understand what that leverage is so you know how to do more. And these are opportunities for you to do many big things. So people say, what should I invest in when I'm young? It does make sense here and there to look at investment strategies. But at the end of the day, the most important thing to remember is that you want to build the habit of investing by understanding the rule of 72, which I'm already sure you've heard of. And that is that you're going to use dollar cost averaging to put money in a consistent manner. Now, a lot of people say, well, I'm going to learn how to day trade and I'm going to find this stock or that stock and I'm going to become better at this sort of thing. Yeah, you could do that. But really, at the end of the day, if you've got a good financial manager when you get older that manages some of that sort of thing, the most important thing for you to remember isn't picking something great and timing the market. It's making sure that you have the consistency to put money into the market on a regular basis and then let the person who's doing the investing know whether or not you're going to be conservative, aggressive, or whatever it might be, and allow for that to take place. Now, I am not talking you out of being more particular and understanding particular and direct investments like Warren Buffett buying undervalued stocks or anything like that. What I'm talking to you about, though, is that you can't buy anything if you're not disciplined about it, or if you chase a shiny object and you put a whole bunch of money in one thing because you're really excited about it. Now you have no money to routinely invest in a consistent manner over a long period of time to build wealth. So keep these things in mind. But the most important thing to remember is this. There will be people that will start investing when they're 18 years old, and they will invest as much as they possibly can until they're 65 years old so they can retire. Or some of them want to retire earlier, but you can still do the math of what I'm talking about. So think about that. They work for about 47 years as hard as they possibly can investing so that they can have a retirement plan. Well, that is pretty cool and it's a good idea, but how long is your retirement? What are you going to live to? Your 80, 85? You have 15, 20 years of playing pickleball and, you know, wow, big deal. I mean, go for it. I definitely would save. I massively encourage people to invest for retirement. But what is your ultimate retirement plan? I mean, if you would work 47 years to be able to play a nice game of pickleball and do some golf and take a couple of cruises, what would you do to have eternal bliss forever for the rest of your life? That's the investment you should look toward while you're building your retirement. And all good things are going to happen. You can go out there and you can become a giant. We can go slay dragons together.
All right. And we will be right back with our Q&A segment here at the Dave Duran Show. This is the Dave Duran Show with Dave Duran. Okay, Dave, we're back with Q&A. So as always, for our listeners, you're welcome to send Dave questions to dave@leadinggiants.com. We'll take a look at them here on air and read them out loud, of course, and answer them as well. This week, we have one from Alex, Dave. Alex asks, well, he says, Dave, you successfully built and scaled companies while maintaining a strong, unique culture. What strategies do you employ to ensure that your company culture remains intact and thrives, especially during periods of rapid growth or significant change? Additionally, how do you personally reinforce these cultural values within your teams?
So I'm assuming that Alex is asking this question because he's in the same situation or wants to be in the same situation. So first of all, kind of an implied, or at least I'm assuming there's a compliment there to him, because why else would you ask a question, right? There are a couple of different things to remember. First of all, cultures erode 1% a day. It's a good way to look at it. So if you don't work on building your culture, making your culture a better culture, in 100 days, it can radically change. And so you want to constantly make it better. It's a little bit like just the health of your body. If you neglect what you're eating and you don't exercise, or you're eating the wrong things, your health can erode. And so it's important to turn that around and to become proactively enthusiastic about it. So a culture needs to have within it an understanding of human nature. We desire big and great things. The transcendentals are actually a major part of our cultures. No matter what a company has done deliberately or accidentally, if they've ever had a good culture, it is because they know that people are attracted to what is good, true, beautiful, and united. The transcendental desires. And most companies would never say, hey, our company's built on the transcendentals, okay? But if it's a good company, people like it. What is goodness? Well, goodness is basically that the thing fulfills the purpose of the maker. Okay, now we can look at that very easily from a God perspective and to say, okay, I was made by God. I need to fulfill that purpose, and then that would be good. But the perfect good is God, of course. God is perfectly good, and we're attracted to good things. If a meeting is designed to settle a budget question and everybody goes to the meeting and all they do is talking about what they're going to do that weekend and they don't accomplish the goal of the meeting, well, the maker of that meeting did not have that meeting meet its purpose. And so people leave the meeting and they say, how was the meeting? It was bad. Why? Well, it didn't fulfill its purpose. If you did fulfill the purpose, people say, how was the meeting? It was good. Why? We did what we were supposed to do. So that's creating a meeting and even have that happen. So you want to build a culture where goodness is a part of it, but also truth and beauty. And the reason that truth is so important is because it should be apparent. But the idea is that when people are in a false environment where people promise things like advancement, or they promised, responsibilities, or they want you to do something, but they don't provide you the proper tools, anything that feels like a lie within the organization erodes the culture because there's no trust in it. The truth equals trust. And so it's super important. Not only that, the speed of your organization moves way faster when there's a lot of trust, and you can't have trust without things being true. Beauty is another really great thing, because in beauty, you've got like clarity and you've got symmetry, you've got proportion, right? So if you're going to have, again, a meeting, you need to be clear about what the meeting is going to be, and then you can have a beautiful outcome. Okay. You need to take the meeting within the context of the larger picture, which is to have kind of that proportion and to understand what that is, right? So basically, I always ask people, if you're going to build a great culture, just ask yourself this question. Is your company good, true, and beautiful? Do you have a good product? Is it a good place to work? Is it a beautiful place to work? Do people tell the truth? Are you united? Or is your company bad, ugly, a lie, and divided? And, you know, things like DEI, for example, you know, these things divide people. You know, you literally, if I said this statement to a person who's really into DEI, I said, never discriminate. Discrimination is wrong. Never hire based on race or gender. They would be offended by that. A DEI person would literally be offended by something that is totally good. Never discriminate. Discrimination is wrong. Never hire based on race or gender, because they hire based on race and gender. So in order to be a DEI person, you have to say discrimination is good, and I will not give you a job because of the color of your skin. I will not give you a job because of your gender. I will only give you a job if you have this gender and you have this color of skin. That's totally bad. And it will eventually crush companies when companies do this. And that's why a lot of them are departing from it. But there's a lot of children in HR departments right now, and a lot of little boys and girls that are in the position of CEO, and they should stay at the kid table. Eventually, there's going to be a problem for them, and they're going to be thrown out. But the problem is when you put these things into massive companies, large companies, there's a lot of money. There's a lot of money you need to burn through doing stupid things before eventually it's going to catch up to you. And a lot of these are slow burns, because they'll do these hires, but they won't run the company based on the same principles. They'll run them on different principles, so it's an artificial thing. So the people that enter into the organization realize, wait, at some point merit has to take place. And, you know, it just becomes a debauchery. And that has a lot to do with culture. All of these things do. So seek what's true, seek what's good, seek what's beautiful, seek what's united. And they ask yourself, is every part of my business that way? And if it is, you're going to have a great culture. But you have to remind people of it on a regular basis.
Yeah, I've had the unfortunate experience of having worked at what was once an amazing company, great culture, and they started believing a lot of these, you know, just lies and implementing it into and forcing it down the employees' throats. And a lot of good people left because, you know, for the right reasons. I mean, they weren't seeking the truth.
I just talked to an executive for a company, owned a European company. And he said that there are three initiatives that they ask you to put together in your annual plan. And one of those initiatives is DEI. And it's like, seriously, you're going to spend one third of your time planning on how to be a racist, discrimination, gender person. You're going to literally take time to teach people how to discriminate against others for the color of their skin. That's just wrong. You should never do it. Hire the best people. End of story. If you hire the best people, you're going to have the best people. And you're going to probably end up diverse when you do that, because you're going to find the best people everywhere. And if you're not diverse, it's because people probably didn't want to work there. You know, it's a crazy idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Dave, we'll move on to a question from Jesse. Jesse says, as someone who continuously pushes the envelope, this is for you, Dave, in both personal and professional realms, what practices or habits have you found most effective by your own leadership development? How do you stay ahead in a constantly evolving and competitive landscape? And what advice would you give to emerging leaders to foster their growth while maintaining their well-being? Ooh, this is a good one.
Well, I mean, two things. One is you have to build you while you're building what you're growing. And if you don't do that, you can't get it done. You can't give what you don't have is one of the most important principles for a leader. So if you're going to be effective as a leader, you have to actually just have something people would want to follow. And so you need to be a person of influence, because leadership is all about influence. So you'd say, well, how can I become influential? Well, people who are influential have their act together. They have order in their life. You can see it because they are quite often in good shape. Now, some people go way too far on this, and they're like, you have to have this like iconic image in order to have influence. That's silly. But you have to demonstrate enough that you you don't have like this massive vice of lack of self-control, or it will reduce your influence. Now, there are many people who aren't really in that good of shape that are still highly influential. So I'm not pinning this all on one thing. But there are certain people that aren't attracted to that, and it reduces influence. That's all I'm saying. The second thing is to make sure that you have knowledge of what it is you're sharing. If you are in perfect shape, but you don't know anything about what you're talking about, you're going to have zero level of influence at all. I'd rather be around a person who is not in good shape that knows a ton any day. But if you have both, you've just elevated your influence. Okay. Have your personal life in order. If you have your personal life in order and your friends are important to you and you take care of them, your family is important to you and you take care of them, people see that and they say, wow, this person is willing to sacrifice for somebody. So when you do demonstrate that sacrifice that you're providing to other people, people say, I want to listen to this person. See, we have a kind of an innate thing where we want to take advice from somebody who we believe can actually provide or protect us. Those are two things that are kind of innately attractive to somebody else. They can somehow protect me from dangers by either educating me on how to do that or literally protecting me. And they can provide something to me. They can provide, you know, an opportunity, a job, money, finances, food, shelter, whatever it is. Or they can provide for me the tools for myself to have that. And if you demonstrate these things in your life, you have knowledge, you take care of yourself, you have order, you have sacrifice, people are going to start to recognize it and they're going to see it. But there's another one too that they need to see. They need to see like enthusiasm and dedication toward the objective or the goal that you want to accomplish. If they don't find you that you're into what's happening, they're going to depart, because if you're not into it and you're leading it, then why would I be into it? So you have to demonstrate your enthusiasm directly to them and communicate it in a way that they know you're committed to what your goal is and what you're leading them through.
Yeah, thanks, Jesse, for sending that question in. Again, for those of you listening, feel free to send Dave questions to dave@leadinggiants.com. Dave, we have one from John. John says, I have a full-time job and a desire to give back to my church. My family and career take up almost all of my time, but I've had this desire to start a ministry for men in my local parish. I've connected with other men who are in similar situations, and they're ready to start it. Before committing, how would you tackle this, being a high performer, father, and being involved in ministry yourself?
So the question, Nico, to clarify is basically they're just saying, you know, how do I add this to my plate?
Correct.
Right. I wouldn't worry too much about it, frankly. And the reason that I wouldn't worry about this now, if you were saying, and so what I want to do is I want to start a band and I want to perform across the country on weekends, that would be different. Men don't require an enormous amount of time to influence. And to have a men's group and for your family, your wife and your children to know that you're spending time on this is really good for them. I mean, this is the type of thing that if they see you engage in it and you leave to go do this on occasion once a week or whatever amount of time you're going to spend on it, you're fortifying them. I here's how I look at it. I remember when I had my first son, I was like, oh my goodness, you know, I love him so much. I don't know how I'd even have room to love a second child. God gives you a second child and you realize you didn't actually have room. Your heart was only big enough to love that child. So what he does is he gives you a bigger heart. And that's pretty cool. And then you see your heart gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And you're like, well, my heart is so big. I love all of them. But he didn't give me 24 hours and then another 24 hours and then another 24 hours. I mean, there's now all these kids and the same number of hours in a day. And I remember seeing something pretty awesome. I remember hugging one of my kids and playing with him and looking across the room and seeing when the other kids watch me do it and them almost feeling the same amount of warmth that I was providing the other child because they felt love in the home and they knew that that love that I gave that child was equal to the love that I gave them. And the watching of that was like enough for them. There are other examples like this. And when your kids see that you're doing something for somebody else, and they know that their parents are good people. Like just to sit back and go, my dad's a good guy. He's willing to help these other guys. He's willing to sacrifice. He's willing to be there. He's a good friend. That is absolutely worth it. And even though it does take a little bit of time from the family, it provides a certain cultural element and lesson for the rest of the kids. Now, there is a point of diminishing return. I mean, are you doing that every day? And now all of a sudden you're showing your kids that your priority is these other guys and not them. That becomes a problem. So all good ideas taken too far, with some exceptions, by the way, become bad ideas. So it's important to keep that in mind. But hey, go for it. Do it. Sounds like you are a high-performing person and you're not going to have any problem making that happen. Just kind of rein it in a little bit, because high performers have a tendency for somebody to put more on their plate and they say yes and more on their plate and they say yes and yes and yes until they're eating too much.
Absolutely. Dave, we have a last one from Erica. Erica says, Dave, in your experience, how do you balance holding on to your core vision for your company while staying adaptable and responsive to the market? Specifically, can you share a time when you had to pivot significantly from your original vision, and how did you navigate that transition?
Yes, I have seen people do this all the time, where they get super committed to an idea and then they can't pivot. They get stuck. They don't believe or understand the power of innovation. So I remember when I started, and I'll just give a practical example of Best Version Media. This is a print company that we started in 2007. Everybody was leaving print like it was a burning building. I even had a colleague one time say, you start a print company, what are you going to do next? Start a VCR company? They were making fun of me. And what I remember telling the people in the organization is the reason we're doing this isn't because we have some penchant for print. We don't love print, but what we love are results. And the results that we wanted were not only readership results for people in the community to be built together, to bond neighbors together, but we also knew there's a great opportunity for local vendors to reach great people. And that connection was missed in the way print was done, and also missed in the way digital was done. So I said, we're a results company. We're not a print company. And the greatest way to get results to both the neighbors and to the sponsors is this delivery method. And it certainly was. And it continues to grow for that reason. But we, as a results company, said, if there's any additional way that we can enhance that, we're going to. And clearly, we enhanced it with all sorts of digital products that are good solutions for both the neighbors and the the vendors too, but without ever compromising one over the other. You see, a lot of people would rather, if they fell out of a boat with 10 gold coins and the gold coins were so heavy that, you know, they were going to just drown, they couldn't swim their way back up to the boat or to the shore. But if they just dropped one gold coin out, they could swim to the top and they could go invest their 9 coins. Some people have an idea and they hang on to it all the way to the bottom of the ocean. And it's better instead to say, well, how can I release this thing that I've really loved? Because I can have a better solution if I do release it. And so you have to stay docile. And one of the worst things is when the original idea was yours. Okay. And it does go well, especially if it goes well and the original idea was yours. And now people want to innovate on it. And you want to, well, let me tell you about the day where everybody had a bad idea and I had a good idea. And my good idea is the one that won the day. And look, it's brought us to where we are now. And you stay in that. Well, that good idea can become a bad idea over time. I mean, if you're sitting there arguing for how important it is to continue to build the Model T Ford, you're not going to sell too many of them. So you have to make sure that you are willing to innovate and move to the next thing.
Great questions here today, Dave. We have one more question coming up after these short messages here at the Dave Durant Show on Relevant Radio. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the Dave Durant Show. I'm Nico, Dave's Chief of Staff at Leading Giants and producer here at the Dave Durant Show on Relevant Radio. So we have one more question for you all, and this is actually a going back to the archives, really, one of Dave's old shows on YouTube on his channel, Durant On Demand, was answering 100 questions for founders and entrepreneurs who are building and scaling their businesses to $100 million plus. Now, this is obviously something that can pertain to any business owner or anyone really interested in learning how to start business, how to scale business, and so on and so forth. In fact, we actually have a couple seminars that we are lining up here in the month of June. So if you're interested in more information on that, go ahead and send me an email at nico@leadinggiants.com, and I'll go ahead and get you hooked up with more information there. These seminars will be specific to sales and entrepreneurs. Basically, if you're a salesperson, if you're involved in sales in any way, shape, or form in your organization or in your business, and you want to learn to sell better, to develop an appropriate sales presentation, these seminars will help you do that. And if you're a business owner, small business owner, maybe you're a solopreneur, so to speak, you have a one-person business and you're the owner-operator, and you're looking to scale so that you are no longer tied to the operations of the business, but rather you're actually a business owner in the sense of you're overseeing and leading other people, there's going to be seminars that will apply to you there as well. So feel free to send me an email to nico@leadinggiants.com. I'll get you more information here. We're going to be starting those seminars in June. But the reason I bring that up is because a lot of the questions that we've actually answered on the Dave Durant Show here will be expanded upon in magnitudes, if you will, on these seminars. And so I think that you will find them incredibly valuable if you're in one of those two roles or positions, sales or business. And in fact, it's funny because Dave mentioned that usually the CEO is the number one salesperson in their business, and that's a huge mistake. So I think oftentimes is the case that the CEO will want to learn to sell better. And I think that you'll find a lot of great information in there, but you'll also be interested to find out how to remove yourself from that operations role. So anyways, without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and bring up the old archive question here on how to start a business. If you're interested in that, should you start a solopreneurship, if you will, a solo business, basically no partners, or should you partner up with someone? And so here it is.
Okay. So the question is, since I have decided to open the business, do I do it alone or do I do it with partners? How do I frame that out? How do I start that? A lot of these questions are actually, when I have people ask them, related to what, you know, do I form an LLC, S Corp, C Corp, that sort of different type of thing. That's really something you want to go to your accountants and your lawyers with. I've done it in many different ways, and it's not really the same type of question. You can have partnerships really with all of those types of formations. But I would say that when you're looking at whether or not you should go solo or you should go alone, solo or alone, how about that? whether you're looking at whether or not you want to go solo or alone, those are the same things. In case you're confused on that, you probably shouldn't get into business yourself, and I'm destroying my credibility right start. But if you want to go by yourself, or if you want a partnership, or if you want more than just two people involved, what should you consider? So I've done it pretty much all of those different ways. I will tell you from my experience what I believe is good, but it does not mean that all of the options are not good. I think all of those options can be good. It has to do with the people you're working with. One of the reasons that going by yourself might be good is that you're considering the outcomes already, and you want to do this. You always want to build a business with the end in mind. So let me give you an example. You're saying to yourself, I have a particular industry that I'm getting into, that I know a lot about, that I know how to manage, that I also realize that I want to sell this business. And in this particular vertical, the multiple on EBITDA, profit, if not familiar with the term yet, okay, this is basically the way you measure your profit. It's not just a regular profit. I can get into the accounting side of what EBITDA actually is an acronym for later on. But right now, you would say that's the multiple, okay? I'm going to take the profits, and a multiple means that somebody would be willing to pay me 2 times that, 4 times that, 10 times that. That's basically our selling a business, 20 times that. So you say to yourself, you know what? This is an amazing vertical. People are buying these businesses at 20 times EBITDA, so that's what I want to do. And I want to go solo on that because I want all of that 20 times EBITDA at 100% because I own it all. Well, it's not really a bad way of looking at it. I mean, this has worked out for a lot of different people, and it kind of depends on, you know, whether or not you actually could pull it off. I would say, though, that if you have a great partner, you might be able to get that 20 times EBITDA. And let's say, for example, you have a $1 million profit. And you're going to get 20 times EBITDA. You get $20 million for it. This like would be a great scenario, okay? And for some businesses, it is that way. Others, it's like 1 times EBITDA. But you want 20 times. And so you build the business to $1 million in EBITDA, and you're going to sell it. You get your $20 million. That's good, but you might end up saying, well, if I had a partner, could we grow it to $60 million? In about that period of time, because, you know, we're able to synergistically make this happen. Now, clearly, if you sold it for anything less than $40 million, you would have made less on it if that first case scenario would have come through, okay? But once you go above $40 million, now you have an exponential way of looking at this. Partnerships can be challenging, though, if you certainly don't have the right person involved. I mean, I will tell you that if I've ever seen things go awry most often, it's a 50-50 partnership, because nobody knows really who's in charge. And you certainly could have kind of like, some sort of management formula that allows you to actually be in control on certain decisions at 50-50. But at the end of the day, when you're 50-50 ownership, it's pretty easy for somebody to put their foot down and say no. And so you have to have for sure the right partner in order to do that. And I'm telling you that I've seen really a much bigger graveyard of businesses that are 50-50 than I have seen champagne bottles cracked open. But again, it's a personal choice. What I have enjoyed most would be like the tri-partnership or maybe a 5-person partnership. One of the reasons for this is because you really have to think things through. So here's what happens when you're alone. You want to make a decision, you make it. And certainly you need to tell the people that are on your team why you want to do it, but they don't have to really be that invested, and your argument doesn't have to be that good or articulate to get it done, okay? Because it's happening because you said so. With a 50-50 partner, you need to make the argument pretty strong, but you could have the better argument and the other person could just say no, and now the business is stopped all the time. It's a classic saying that I like to remind people of, that most people would rather be right to their own demise than wrong to their own prosperity, meaning that there are a lot of people who just, they like being right. So they have a wrong idea, but they want to be right about it. So they just sink their ship. A classic example would be, I can't succeed here. Okay, well, you know, this market doesn't work. People don't like the product. And well, there are tons of other people selling that product in that market, and they're doing really well, but you're saying it can't work and you can't succeed there. So how are you going to prove that? Fail. Okay, well, good for you. You were right to your own demise as opposed to wrong to your own prosperity. So keep that in mind. Partnerships that are in odd numbers work out pretty well because you have to make a strong argument to your partners why you want to do things. Now, there has to be somebody in charge. There has to be a chief executive officer who has the ability to make decisions and not constantly go back to the partners of the board for approval on everything, because then you can't get anything done. But when you get to kind of weightier issues, it's really good to be able to go and work these things out with good, valued partners, because you're going to be more on your game to make your argument when that happens, and it elevates your virtue. It's kind of a natural virtue maker. And you'll hear about, I'll talk about virtue all day long. If you've ever listened to anything that I have on the radio, if you listen to any of my podcasts or anything at all, you're going to hear me talk a lot about virtue. Why? Because it is the number one indicator for success. Sadly, though, you cannot measure virtue on Myers-Briggs or personality tests. You can't do it, which is why people test out perfectly for being the best leader. I'm ENTJ. I should be able to lead to these levels, but they fail. Why? Because they have vice more than they have virtue. Now I have a person that doesn't measure up to the right formula, but they succeed. Why? Because they have higher virtue than somebody else. So keep that in mind. So a partnership forges virtue kind of like a marriage does. You have to be sacrificial in it. And I talked a little bit on the first video about how you want to love your people to success. I'm going to come back to this theme. I know it sounds a little warm and fuzzy and cheesy and blah, but it's actually really, it's tough. I mean, you know, when people misinterpret the word love when they just go, oh, no. I mean, you know, hey, frankly, I love my kids enough to make them cry. Okay. So, I mean, the point is you want to give them all the wonderful things they want and all of the fun, loving, exciting things. But at the end of the day, there are times you're going to have to upset them because you love them, right? So working in a partnership, when you love your partners, and, you know, in America, sadly, we have like one word for love in English, and it's like, I love my wife and I love French fries. How insulting to your wife that we use the same word. Whereas like in Greek, you have a different level of love all the way to agape, which is the love of God, right? So what we have to realize, or is it, maybe it's the love of God toward us. I think it might be actually, we need to talk to somebody who's maybe a theologian or who understands Greek. It goes one of those two directions. But the point would be that we need to love people appropriately to the relationship that we have with them in the workplace. Why? Because it's sacrificial. It always accompanies sacrifice. And if you have people that will work with you the same way, you're going to both make sacrifices together to get things done. Now, the last thing I want to say about partnerships of any type at all, whether it's a 50-50 partnership or whether or not you're going to be working with other people, is they have to be able to bring something real to the table. And one of the biggest mistakes that people make is that they only bring a partner to the table because they have money. Now, by the way, it's not a bad idea to bring a partner to the table because they have money. It's a good idea. But if that person's going to put their money on the table and then they're going to make all sorts of bad decisions and lord over everybody because of the money, you can't get anything done, then everybody loses the money. So they have to have something to contribute. And sometimes the value of contribution is silence. That's not a bad thing to contribute. So if a person's like, hey, I'll put the money in, I'm going to walk away, I trust you guys, you can build it, go for it. Well, that's a pretty good partner. But oftentimes they have a particular skill set. Maybe their skill set is that they're good under the banner of administration or production or sales. Something that maybe complements what it is that you're doing, so you can all kind of get off into your right places and enjoy the fact that you each have kind of cohesive, synergistic type of talents, which is a good idea too. But I would say the main thing is that you really want to look at the outcome of the business. What is it going to look like at the end? And would these relationships actually get me there? Also, remember this, that while I'm advocating for the idea of, you know, maybe working with a handful of people to build a business, it is way easier to add them as you go than it is to actually get rid of them along the way. So if you're uncertain at first, probably a better idea to go solo. And you might find that in going solo, you're able to keep it that way the whole time. You can incentivize people with other ways. And then let's remember, too, that you can oftentimes do things where you have, you know, type of thing like a management pool where there's an opportunity for people to actually earn into the business in some way, shape or form. It's not always entirely full on ownership, although you can, you know, start to siphon those up. You build a business to a certain level, by the way, and you offer somebody to come into the business by buying their way in, it's a pretty appealing thing for them and for you. Or, you know, it's kind of difficult when you get into them. This is another thing to keep in mind. If you build a business to a certain value and now you're bringing a partner, you can't just give them something. They have to pay taxes on whatever it is that you're giving them in the business. So a lot of times people want to do this, but they're looking at a person saying, okay, I want to give you a certain equity in the business. The business is worth X amount. So now you have to pay taxes you can't afford. So I can't actually give it to you, even though I wanted to do that. So there's a lot of things you want to think about just from the financial side. So go to your accountant, go to your, maybe an investment banker that you know, and talk to them about how these things play out.
maybe an attorney if you're able to do that. But, you know, at the same time, too, you can overthink some things about starting a business because a lot of them are pivotable at earlier times. You know, once you get a little bit of traction, I would revisit some of these things once you do have something go from concept to reality, because it's not necessarily a final decision when you kick things off. Okay.
All right. So we hope you enjoyed that throwback segment from Dave himself on his YouTube channel. And I actually invite you all to check out his YouTube channel. We've been getting a lot of really good traction there. It's more so geared towards the business content style in terms of formatting and that sort of thing and the theme and topic. But a lot of it intersects with the topics that we've discussed here on the radio. And so I think it'll be very valuable if you're looking to start a business, scale a business, and or getting, you know, into sales and becoming a better sales representative in your company, how to grow in your closing percentages, how to get more leads and gain kind of a better footprint, if you will, in your career there as a sales rep. So we will be launching these seminars, which are separate from obviously his YouTube channel, on leadinggiants.com. So if you have any questions on those seminars here starting in June, feel free to send me a question to nico@leadinggiants.com. We're always welcoming questions, of course, live on the radio. You can send those over to Dave at dave@leadinggiants.com, and he'll answer these live on the radio. So I appreciate you all for listening. Thank you so much. And we will see you all next week here at the Dave Durant Show. God bless.